This is tape number 5, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor of English Thomas Schaub, October 16th, 2006. So, Tom, we have you on your way to Iowa.
Yes.
To work on your PhD.
Yes, I had that Danforth funding, and I had lost my job, so it seemed pretty clear that I should head back to graduate school. And I had applied to a number of places and been accepted into them, but I chose Iowa because I had found that when I was at Yale and at Buffalo, I just was lacking the social surroundings that I needed to support me, I suppose. And while Iowa didn't have the cachet of Brown or Yale or other places that I've been accepted into, Iowa did have a very fine workshop program there. It was particularly noted in American literature and American studies, and I had a number of close friends who lived there, working as one was working as a carpenter, another guy was there working in the children's hospital, and it just seemed like a place that I could make a home for 4 or 5 years, get my degree, and then decide what I wanted to do, because I wasn't sure even then that I wanted to be a college professor, that is, that I wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. I did know that I wanted to continue my education, and the other would come out in the wash, as it were. I went back to Iowa to study, to read American and British literature, philosophy, what have you, and get the degree and at least take it that far. I don't know what there is to say about Iowa City. It was, apart from the fact that it was, I think it was a good choice for me. My friendships did help me to feel at home there and to give me a kind of social base outside of academia where I could feel at ease and enjoy myself. And eventually, within a few years, I did become, naturally enough, quite at home in the cohort that I went to Iowa with and got to know a number of close friends through seminars and whatnot. I don't know what's important to say here, except that Iowa had at that time a wide distribution requirement, so that I had to take courses in 18th century in 18th century Milton, Chaucer, and I did that. Though I petitioned my way out of the 18th century requirement. Once I got into that class, the professor was sort of full of himself, and I'd had so much excellent 18th century training mm-hmm. at the Newberry Library that I figured I didn't need this, and if there was a way out of it, I would find a way. And so I wrote one of my letters to the graduate director, and was excused from that class. So I was very pleased with that. But particularly from my perspective today, I'm very pleased with the education I got there because of those distribution requirements. I read widely in Milton and in Chaucer. I took Fred McDowell's British literature lecture course. It was a combined graduate undergraduate course, and he took us from William Blake to Auden. And he was a fabulous lecturer. He was fun. He was a real goldmine for people studying for prelims, because he handed out stuff on he handed out plenty of material, bibliography and synopses of this or that, and his own a view of what was important about these people, so that you could accumulate quite a notebook just from Fred. He was really a delightful guy and brilliant. And I still have that notebook of files from that class. Yeah, even though I don't teach British literature. Let's see, I took a course from, I can't remember his name now, in Chaucer and medieval literature. And that this guy was a fan of, I think it's D.W. Robinson or G.W. Robinson. I still got the book, a number of books. And he was, I think that old Robinson, who I think was at Princeton, attitude toward the Middle Ages and understanding Chaucer as a kind of an author who drew upon the Gothic image and all kinds of texts that were part of this guy's teaching is out of date now. But I found it wonderfully interesting, and it went together nicely with the courses that I had had in medieval literature in college. So I really enjoyed that thoroughly. And I had friends in both those classes, the Milton and the Chaucer class, that had no interest in a Christian-centered author and the moral values that one finds in their work. And I always thought they were rather narrow-minded about this. There's great beauty and wisdom to be found in these two writers. And without those distribution requirements, many of the people getting PhDs at Iowa at that time would not have taken those courses. Maybe even me. You know, as perfect a person as I am, I may have chosen to go directly to my interests in the modern era. But so I took courses from Fred and from, I've forgotten the name of the medievalist. He was really, he wore the same suit every day for the entire semester. It was a black suit. The guy was a Puritan, you know, at heart. I think he bicycled into school, and he argued, for example, that Romeo and Juliet is a satire.
Really?
Yeah, so the idea that we have of romance and boy-girl love and all that, he considers to be a modern profanation and depravity that would have been recognized immediately as simply silly on the part of Shakespeare's audience. So that was the way in which he read Chaucer, you know, in the Parson's Tale, and he sort of read his view of Chaucer forward into what we think of as early modernity. And I found it fascinating, though wrong. But
you were clear at the time that, in your mind, that it was wrong?
Oh, absolutely. Though, interestingly, from my own perspective at that point, 24 years old, I'd had enough entanglement with women and with love and lust and all of those things that are so prominent in medieval literature, that I really took a liking to some of the medieval iconography of love as an arrow that goes in through the eyeball. You know, you see this beautiful woman and then it, you know, stabs you in the heart, as being a kind of something to be avoided, you know, that it upended you. And put your priorities, as Chaucer would say, oops-a-doon, upside down. Oops-a-doon is one of the great little words I have recalled from that many a time. So I think I could say in brief, you know, I spent about 2 years taking coursework for the PhD. But the thing that changed my life, really, my life as an academic at any rate, and helped steer me toward a sort of vocational, I mean, really thinking about college teaching and scholarship as something that might sustain me and that I could do with some excitement and energy was a course I took from Sherman Paul in 20th Century Literature and Culture. Now, Sherman was known as an austere scholar and probably the preeminent scholar at Iowa at the time, certainly in American literature and American studies. He had helped start American studies with a man named Krieger over in history, I believe. I may have that wrong, but there were two or three sort of prominent American studies scholars on campus at the time, and Sherman was one. He'd already written many, many books. He'd written an important book on Emerson. He'd written, at that time, probably still the major book on Thoreau, and done an edition on Walden. He'd gotten interested and written on Louis Sullivan, written a book about Sullivan. Very interested in art and architecture and philosophy and people like, you know, the American tradition in philosophy from, Pierce up through Dewey was, I think, key to his thinking. Though he was, at the time I got to know him, he was starting to read Heidegger. Who knows what he read? He was really an intense, interesting man whose imagination opened up and illuminated everything that he touched upon. I remember his talking with me about, I think I probably brought up some TV show that I was enamored of. And he just immediately went to work on this thing, began talking about his cultural work and this kind of thing that was, at that time, you know, Sherman was somebody who had not gone in the direction of the New Critic, which was the dominant mode of criticism of the 50s and 60s. Sherman was still interested in history and culture as a sort of gluten of literary study. He had studied under Perry Miller at Harvard, and so was, you know, trained in American studies sort of methodology and interest in the politics of literature. And this turned me on. This was very exciting. So we read people from, in that one course, from Gertrude Stein up to George Jackson, Soledad Brother. Yeah, and he had us, but he also had us reading sort of the connective tissue, essays and art, things by John Dewey, by Thorstein Veblen, by Randolph Bourne, by the Seven Arts Movement, the secession photographers, and it, you know, you just got a whole sense of literature emerging out of a culture of ideas and practices that was connected to social and political history. Very exciting to me. And Sherm, standing up there just straight as a, you know, an I-beam, with his high forehead and penetrating gaze, and he would look out over the audience, you know, and he just, he was rather intimidating. So I eventually got to know Sherm fairly well and saw that he just had very high standards. And if you approach those standards with any kind of rigor and scholarly genuineness, integrity, he would sort of let you in, as it were. So that was a course that really excited me. It seemed like this was something worth doing, and that being Sherman Paul was somebody worth being. You know, he was somebody I could identify. He was a guy practicing being a professor that that provided a model for the way in which I could see myself mm-hmm. practicing being a professor. It's kind of an ethical, aesthetic, cultural model there that was deeply appealing to me. I remember going up to him after one of the first lectures and asking him where he had gotten the quotation from Freud, which he had used in the lecture. All therapy is an education in the truth. And I said, and I said, well, where did you get this from Freud? And he said, oh, I don't know. He said, it's somewhere in my reading of Freud. I can't remember where it came from. And then he leaned over the podium and really sort of came toward me and said, are you a philosopher? You know, there was an immediate contact that he was willing to make. He sort of reached out to me and took me seriously. I had asked a question and he said, oh, so what are your interests? And this was in a class of 150 students, graduate and undergraduate. So that was nice, you know. This reminds me of a time when I was in Buffalo and in a class being taught by Angus Fletcher, who was, you know, one of the top guys, I mean, a renowned guy in the field of allegory and medieval and early modern literature. And he used to come in with a shopping bag and sit down in a desk. We'd be in a circle together. It was not a formal seminar table. He was very informal and kindly in his manner, even though he was such a star at Buffalo. And I remember we were reading a poem by Green Thought and the Green Shade. Who's that guy? This is appalling. The guy who this is going to kill me. Yeah, Andrew Marvell. We were reading a poem by his, and the class was talking about the poem in ways that I thought misrepresented or misread a particular sentence. And I was just a first semester student there, and amidst advanced PhDs and dissertators, all in my defensiveness, I felt that they were groveling at the knee of the master, you know. I must have had some sort of a look on my face because Fletcher turned to me and he said, Tom, you seem to have a different idea. And so I told him what I thought about this line. I thought it was being misread. And he said, oh, this is very interesting. It transforms the whole poem, doesn't it? Now, I don't know that he bought my take on the thing. But when Sherm leaned over and addressed me in a kind of familiar interested way, it reminded me of the way Angus Fletcher had been paying attention. And in fact, Fletcher and Sherm both are models for me in the way that I teach. I try to extend that interest and seriousness to my students when I spot it among them. And so Sherm was a model in a number of ways. And I think it was after that semester that I was, that semester finished up in December. And then I spent the next 9 months reading for prelims. And at Iowa at that time, you would read if you had an interest in American literature and culture, you would go to Sherm and you would say, I want to read in American literature and culture, and I want you to be the member of my committee who tests me on that. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in most of the courses I took at Iowa were in British literature. I think the only American course I took was Sherm's course. Huh. And but I was continuing to read in American literature on my own. And so what I did then for prelims was I set up with Wayne Franklin, who's now at Northeastern. I set up with Wayne Franklin a reading list in the American novel from, I don't remember where it started, 18th century to 1970, let's say. And I set up a reading list with Archibald Coolidge in the 19th and 20th century British literature, which took me from the lyrical ballads to Auden.
Okay.
And so I had a lot of McDowell stuff in reserve, as it were. But I wanted to work with Coolidge because Coolidge was such a charismatic oddball. He was, I don't know what he was, whether he was schizophrenic or depressed, or I really don't know what his actual psychological label was, but he would occasionally disappear and be in the hospital in Iowa City. At one point, not while I was at Iowa, that I'm aware of, but at one point, he walked out of class, got into his car, and was finally picked up in New York State somewhere. There was something amiss with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a mesmerizing lecturer. Absolutely mesmerizing. And kids would, you know, graduate students would flood into his courses, whether they were registered or not. And Coolidge didn't care. He probably didn't know if anybody was in the class at all. He would start on the second. You'd sit in class, people would be sitting in there, and the hand would go like this, and he would look up and give you 50 minutes without notes of any kind of sequential scholarship, eloquence, drama, fire. His pitch of his voice would change. He would slam the desk sometimes. I remember once I took two of his courses. One of them was in the English and Philosophy building in the summertime. And just as in Wisconsin, you can get some violent thunderstorms in Iowa City. And Iowa City is often I think it's the Cedar River that flows through Iowa, or maybe it's the Iowa River. You'd think I'd know, but I never quite got that straight. It was a kind of a tornado avenue. And we were in there, and he was lecturing on the Gothic novel. And it was thundering and lightning outside. And the sky turned black as pitch. And he was talking about the Castle of Otranto, something like that. And the mysteries of Udolpho. And there came a... to emphasize a point, he slammed the blackboard. He had his back to us. Sometimes he'd turn around and talk to us with his back to us. And he slammed the board, and at that exact instant, there was this crash. There's lightning stroke and a crash of thunder simultaneously. The lightning must have been very close. And I'm telling you, the class was 3 feet out of their seats. And it was as if Coolidge were, you know, the god of the universe there. It was just striking. So I worked with him. And one of the highlights of that reading that I did with him was that he not only wanted me to read a ton of stuff, ton of literature, but he had me reading like the Cambridge Encyclopedia of English Literary History for these sections. So a lot of stuff there. And he had me read some stuff in the history of the novel. Like that was when I read Ian Watt, which was probably the major book at that time. But even more important for my purposes and more interesting to me was he had me read philosophy, some of the backgrounds to the Romantic era in particular. So that's when I first read Immanuel Kant for the first time. I read the Critique of Judgment. I read Shaftesbury, there was a whole bunch of these characters in the 18th century. It had to do with literary aesthetics that were important to the late 18th and early 19th century writers. So that was, and I had 9 months to read. Mm-hmm. And this was, I have to admit, a gift of the gods, because I had that Danforth Fellowship. Now, students here at Wisconsin, for example, when they're getting ready to take their prelims, they might not be taking coursework, but they're teaching. They usually have at least two sections of something, and sometimes five sections, if they're, you know, if they're assisting in a lecture class. So I was able to simply sit in my upstairs apartment in the kitchen, usually. Sometimes I go in my bedroom, lie down, and read, which I love to do. I just read all day long.
Every day?
Every day. And I kept notes on everything that I read. I made connections. I wrote little things about, you know, Faulkner and Fenimore Cooper and the Gothic and American literature, just stuff that would, you know, occur to me, or that I would read, and things like Leslie Fiedler's Love and Death in the American Novel, and other things that I was reading at that time. You know, I read all the stuff that was big then, or had been big just prior to the revolution in literary study that took place with Derrida's lecture at Johns Hopkins in 68, Foucault, and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I was, and I was reading some of that stuff. I read S.C. and Roland Barthes' mythologies, but you know, I hadn't been taking that in courses. Hadn't been taught to me. It wasn't a part of my thinking yet. So I was reading the big American studies stuff, like Chase's The American Novel and Its Traditions. I read Matheson's what was that called? A big book by Peter Matheson, The American Renaissance. I read Richard Broadhead on Melville and Hawthorne, and so I'm reading all this stuff. And then at 4 o'clock every day, more or less, punctually, you know, and you can't do this unless you're young. You know, you can't read all day long like that. And I would take, here was my schedule. Absolutely, to the minute, I seemed to wake up every morning at 10 to 7. And after some ablutions and I'd make some coffee, I would begin to read until about 9 o'clock. Because I found that if I had breakfast right away, it interfered with my cognition, my alertness. Then about 9 o'clock, when I was starving, I'd have a little breakfast, listen to NPR radio out of Iowa City, and then go back to reading, have lunch around 12:30, and then read until 4, and then go play tennis at 4 o'clock with a friend of mine who was also reading for his prelims. And then I would have dinner. And I would read probably from about 7 to 10 at night. And then quite often go to George's Buffet, which was a local bar about 4 or 5 blocks away, and have a couple of 7-ounce beers with some friends of mine, Ebinger and Loomis, other people I knew from outside the department. Though I turned George's Buffet into an English department bar, I was responsible for that. And
let the record clearly
let the record show that I turned George's Buffet into an English department bar. That's where all the graduate students began going, because I would bring them there. And it was off the beaten track. So, but sometimes if I were reading something really absorbing and long, I'd have to forego George's. And I remember reading Moby Dick in a day and a half. And, you know, you think, well, how thorough could your reading have been? And probably not that thorough. And yet, I have 5 or 6 single-spaced type pages on almost everything that I read, including Moby Dick. And I had little markers that I would put in sections that I thought were really key to understanding the novel. And I think I finished that book about 1 o'clock in the morning one night, at the same time that Schubert's quintet was playing on the radio. I remember that distinctly. It was haunting. This was the quintet that Arthur Rubinstein said he wanted playing while he was dying. It's just a remarkable piece of music, which I went out and bought the next day.
Really?
But to read this, I mean, to listen to this, have this in the background, it was just sublime hypnosis. And, you know, Melville's own prose is hypnotic itself. So that was a great experience, actually.
This concludes side one of tape 5. This is side 2 of tape 5, Tom Schaub.
So I completed the reading, began to get quite anxious and nervous, as prelims readers will do, in about the week before the exam. The exam was a 3-day written exam, one day in each of the 3 areas, and then there was an oral exam. And it really went off without a hitch. I didn't distinguish myself particularly. There was one notable moment at the beginning of the exam that I always recall with amusement. When I got into the exam room, Wayne Franklin was lying on top of the seminar table in an effort to sort of calm me, I suppose, and try to get me to be at ease. And then he said, he climbed off the seminar table, seated himself, and he said, "Let me begin with an easy question just to make you put you at ease." Now, the interesting background to this is that I was so restless and anxious about the exam that the exam was in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, for crying out loud. And so I walked downtown, trying to walk off some of this energy and negative energy, and went over to the art museum. So I went in, and the art museum along the river there in Iowa City, a beautiful, beautiful setting, had a special show devoted to vases and urns. Mm. So that got me thinking about Keats and the Ode on a Grecian Urn and Ode to a Nightingale, and my favorite, perhaps my favorite poem in the English language, which is the Ode to Autumn. So by the time I got back to the apartment, I had been dwelling on this whole thing and had a little bit to eat, though I wasn't hungry. And then I walked down, actually rode my bicycle down to the EPB building, English and Philosophy building, for the oral exam. Wayne asked me, "Tell us in as few words as possible, what is the truth?" And I said to him, "Well, truth is beauty." And Archibald Coolidge said, "And that is all you need to know." And Fred McDowell said, "Well, I guess we're done here."
But if it were true.
If it had been so, yes. But yeah, things went on. It was fine. It was a nice conversation. McDowell, I think, did ferret out the fact that I had not read Carlyle's The French Revolution. When he asked me about it, I told him that my notes on it had burned. And everybody found that amusing, because Carlyle's had finished the book and it had burned up in a fire. And I tried to deflect that and get on to the next question, but I eventually had to say that I hadn't read it. But I had read several other things by Carlyle, so it was fine. But the major interest of that reading for me. Well, I can't say the major interest. I discovered the amazing prose of John Ruskin. Probably was the dark horse for me. That was the great discovery, was John Ruskin. And the fact that he connected aesthetics with politics in his later work, and that great essay that he gave to the town businessman of Bradford, England, which is published in his collected writings under the title Traffic. They hired him. It was like the Kiwanis Club inviting the top architect in the United States to come give them a lecture on this exchange that we want to build. Tell us how we should build this exchange. And he begins the lecture by telling them that he's not going to tell them how to build the exchange, because they don't even care about the exchange. And he lectures them pointedly on the purpose of commerce. That the purpose of grain is not to make money, it is to feed people. And it's just on and on in this vein, you know. It's just fabulous. And the closing sentences of this thing are so moving. They bring a chill to my spine when I read them now and then, as occasionally I do in some of my courses, if I'm talking about aesthetics and politics, and I read them a little Ruskin. But the other thing was that I had gone to Sherm after that class and said, can you give me, do you have a reading list in 20th century criticism and culture? I knew he did. And so he pulled it out of his file and gave it to me. So that was my third area, the American novel and British literature and 20th century American literature, criticism and culture. And that was just eye-opening. The list gives you a sense of, he had developed the list as a dialogue, sort of between, I suppose, Emerson's Party of Hope and Party of the Past. And he takes this idea up through people like Van Wyck Brooks and Joseph Frank and all these other people that are relatively unknown unless you go into American literary study. And I'm not sure who teaches these people anymore anyway, but extraordinarily influential folks. And we're at the time and so on. So we read Mencken, and we read Dewey, and we read Veblen, and more of Randolph Bourne, and Stieglitz, and Joseph Frank, and Van Wyck Brooks' America's Coming of Age. And I mean, you really see a world of ideas and criticism, that criticism is not just some sort of worthless occupation that earns you tenure or something. That American critics have been engaged in battles that show up in places like the Atlantic Monthly and in the New Republic, and that there's an actual public intellectual. Edmund Wilson is another one that I read quite a bit of in this list. So you really see that the literary world in a much more engaged way. That in so many other classes at that time, in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, literature was taught from the standpoint of a T.S. Eliot idea that or Matthew Arnold, that literature is the best that man has thought. It's kind of literature exists in a trans-historical realm, that its greatness is precisely way in which it embodies universal, trans-historical, mythic values. Mm-hmm. Sherm was never one for that view of literature. And through reading these lists under his guidance, I really developed the idea of teaching classes in which I situate literature in the recent social history that my students are not going to know, but which helps them see that the writers are directly responding and engaged with their time, and that in some respects they are vehicles and mouthpieces for the ideology of their time. In other respects, they are taking, they are critiquing and taking issue with what is going on in their time. So, World War I, the Depression, World War II, the Cold War, all of that is foundational for the literature of modern American literature. And you know, that really was the sort of governing thing for me. And my my goal, my dessert that I promised myself after I completed this exam was to finally read Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow. And
that was a conscious decision to delay reading that.
Yes. That had come out the year before, and I had bought it at that time, and I'm embarrassed to say I bought it in paperback. So I don't have a first edition of Gravity's Rainbow, though I'm not a guy that collects first editions, but I'll admit I'd like to have a first edition. You know, years later, after my, I think it was my second chairmanship, my colleague Robert Baker gave me his first edition. But it's some kind of reviewer's first edition, and it's got a little stamp on the not on the on the flyleaf, but on the actual cover of the text on the back of it that any collector would recognize. But I do have something of a first edition, finally, as a gift from Bob. But so I had that sitting on my shelf and was dying to read it because, you know, it begins with this epigraph from Wernher von Braun, in which he says, everything the science has taught me is that the universe is controlled by a god, something like that. Let me get the book. This is the first book one of Gravity's Rainbow. It begins, it's titled Beyond the Zero. And he quotes Wernher von Braun, nature does not know extinction. All it knows is transformation. Everything science has taught me and continues to teach me strengthens my belief in the continuity of our spiritual existence after death. Well, you know, that hit the high points of my interests in religion, mm-hmm. philosophy, literature, and science. I'd always been interested in science. I don't know whether I've made that clear in my comments the last few weeks, but this just seemed like an extraordinary adventure waiting for me. And I figured I could devote a week or so before I jumped into my dissertation project, just give myself a week to read Gravity's Rainbow. Well, I didn't realize how difficult, though difficulty is always a plus for me. I mean, that's a come on, you know, that's a lure for me. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize how difficult it would be, nor did I realize how small the print is on a book that's nearly 1,000 pages long. It's really a mammoth book. And I think it took me maybe a month to read the book. Really? To my satisfaction, going at the pace that I felt the book deserved.
Were you reading every day?
I was reading every day, but I'm sure that I was celebrating and relaxing a little bit. I was, I think, also teaching that fall. Mm. I didn't have to teach. I decided I should have some experience teaching at the college level. So I was teaching, and I'd begun to fashion a thesis that would focus on the way in which the new American history, the way in which American history had been rewritten by the modern critics, by Joseph Frank and Randolph Bourne and Fenwick Brooks and others, the way in which they'd gone back and revalued, to use Nietzsche's term, revalued American literature and made Melville and Whitman and Dickinson and Hawthorne the key players, rather than, you know, Whittier, Whittier, Lowell, and Longfellow. You know, that's what you were taught in college and high school, as these are the great American writers of that period. But, you know, the first book-length Melville biography comes out, I think, in 1922. It's not important. It comes out early in the 20s. And, even D.H. Lawrence, you know, who writes studies in classic American literature, goes back and lifts out, you know, Whitman and Hawthorne and Melville. So you had a new idea of what was significant in American literature and as well as American culture. A new reading of the central ideas and impulses of American culture and politics. And it seemed to me that these ideas began to show up in some of the literature of the late 20s and 30s. So I had this idea that I could write about the transformation of American literature or the degree to which this revaluing of the American past had an influence on the literature being written. So I worked on this for, I would say, at least 3 or 4 months. And the project got larger and larger. I had to read about history and historiography and all kinds of things like that. And every time I went to see Sherm, which might have been 3 times total, I didn't pester him. I knew what I needed to do. But every time I did show up, I would read to him a little passage out of Gravity's Rainbow and talk about how amazing this novel is. Well, after about, I think it was the last time I talked to him about my historical project, he said to me, "Why don't you write your dissertation on Thomas Pynchon?" And I said, "Well, he's not dead yet. He's going to keep publishing." He said, "Well, what work is there out there on Pynchon?" And I said, "Well, there aren't any books at all at the moment." Though it turned out, almost as he spoke, Joseph Slade's Warner Books Introduction to Thomas Pynchon came out, I think. But he said, why not study a writer that you're really excited by? He said, "This other book you can write when you're 50. He said, you need to have really more experience in reading and study to take on a project of this size. Why don't you work on Thomas Pynchon?" And maybe he was thinking of his having studied Emerson. Now, Emerson, you know, by the time he was, that was his dissertation, it was Emerson, which he called The Angle of Vision. And even at that point, Emerson must have been a much bigger mouthful than Thomas Pynchon was, mm-hmm. in terms of criticism, things one had to study. But I said, "Well," he said to me, "what's he got so far?" I said, "Well, he's got 3 novels. The first 2 won prizes. This one is, they're trying to give him a prize, though he, you know, he keeps refusing these prizes. He doesn't seem to be interested in prizes. And he's got 6 short stories, plus an essay in the New York Times Magazine." And he said, "Well, that's enough. You know, you can introduce this writer to," I don't really remember what he said. Mm-hmm. But he said, "Why don't you work on Pynchon?" Well, I just went out of there. I oh my God, now this is something I can do. You know, I really saw immediately how this would shape up. And so it turned out to be a little more daunting than that, because pinching is almost impossible to write about without getting tangled up into a sort of pretzel-like consciousness. It's hard to explain why it would be so difficult, but it is. I guess it's partly because he's a postmodern writer, and so you don't find, I mean, just to say briefly, there isn't any really stable foundation there to push off of. He's always undercutting his own narrative. He's always undercutting the reader. He's very suspicious. In general, he's very suspicious of narrative, of reader identification. His books are political in that, you know, that those aesthetic strategies have that political content, that they mean to undermine the conventions by which we aestheticize the real world.
Tom, this is perhaps an uninformed question. Who was buying his books? Who in America was reading his books? Besides the literati like yourself.
Yeah. Well, Pynchon was, at that time, before the publication of Gravity's Rainbow, Pynchon was a cult figure. Now, who was reading him? I don't know that I could really fill in the blank, but it wasn't particularly academics, because there wasn't much criticism on V or the Crime of Lot 49, and they weren't being taught.
Would your mother have picked up a copy?
No. Oh, no. Wouldn't have been in any Book of the Month Club list or anything like that. To give you some idea, when I graduated from college, I told you about this, didn't I, going out to Berkeley?
Yes.
Finding the Crime of Lot 49?
Yes.
Well, this was just in the apartment of a person who worked at a local coffee shop. There was no, it was just on the bookshelf there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first read it. And I saw these, I think I must have said, these muted post horns all around the Bay Area. Once mm-hmm. I began to find them, began to notice them. And I guess that's the best that I can do there. You know, mm-hmm. I don't have anything really solid to say, Bob, except that he wasn't on any academician's radar, except possibly Robert Scholes, who had turned me on to V.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just curious.
Pynchon's, I mean, one of the first things that people notice about Pynchon, if they pick up these early two books, is that he's writing about searches and about secret societies. He's inventing a kind of alternative history. And this was a deeply political and interesting kind of writing to the New Left, to people who are deeply suspicious of the government, of our place in Vietnam. It was a moment that was perfect for Pynchon. I mean, here's a writer who purposely had no public profile whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
All you had were these mysterious books that were hard to understand, and hard to understand what they meant. Except that they seemed to convey a sense of mystery and of what I came to call critical patriotism, that there was something was wrong with America. Something was wrong with this official history that all of us had been taught in grade school, junior high in particular. And so there was he had developed a kind of cult following. And I guess I would count myself among their number.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Gravity's Rainbow came out, this huge book, it made a huge splash. And suddenly, Time Magazine and Life Magazine became interested in Thomas Pynchon. And it was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and rejected because of passages of profanity and coprophilia that are in one section of the novel. Quite graphic and tactile coprophilia, I must tell you. It really is quite an effect. So at this point, his cover is sort of blown, except that when Time and Life send out their agents, as it were, to find him, they can't find him, and nobody will give him up. And that's true today, even. We have a little bit more knowledge about him today, but at that time, still not much. But at that time, we knew absolutely nothing about him. And we had no interviews, no pictures, no nothing. And occasionally they would run into somebody that said, yes, I know Thomas Pynchon, but I'm not going to tell you anything. He had made it a point. I don't want to be reached. I don't want to be Norman Mailer. I mean, that's my interpretation. I don't want to have any kind of public profile whatsoever. And there's a passage in the Crying of Lot 49 that I always thought was relevant to this, because Oedipa Maas, the main character of the Crying of Lot 49, thinks she may have stumbled onto a segment of America which had achieved whatever else had been denied them. Had achieved at least their own withdrawal from the Republic. Their own secrecy was a political statement. And it seemed to me very likely that the secrecy that Pynchon has kept has been an act on his part of political disengagement. So, anyway, I stumbled around with this Pynchon stuff trying to find a way to write about it. I read all of Pynchon. I read a couple dozen articles that had been published on him. I read the Slade book. And in the fall, this might have been the fall of 75 or 76, probably the fall of 75, Sherm said to me, I hadn't written a chapter yet. It's not unheard of. I mean, you have to do your research. And I had done a tremendous amount of reading and rereading. I read Gravity's Rainbow 4 times before I ever wrote a word about it. And I read The Crime of Lot 49 and V. 49 I probably read 6 or 7, 8, 9, 10 times. It's a short book, in case you don't know. It's the exact length of The Great Gatsby, by the way, which goes into a theory of mine. I see The Crying of Lot 49 as a updated Great Gatsby.
Really?
Yeah, the two are, I put Crying of Lot 49, The Great Gatsby, and Billy Budd into the group of the three great American novellas.
I'll have to read it. So, I wrote papers on The Great Gatsby.
Yeah. So you may notice it. But in any case, a guy named Charles Russell actually wrote about the connection. And I wrote a paper about the same thing just a couple of years ago. But Sherm said to me, I'm going to put The Crying of Lot 49 on my reading list for my graduate class next semester, and I want you to give the lectures. Well, this put the fear of God into me and really concentrated my thinking, as it were. And so I wrote and rewrote, took notes, and finally found a way of talking about this novel. And basically, what I did was make a strength out of what I took to be a problem. which was the way in which Pynchon's writings construct a reader. So, and this eventually became the driving argument of the dissertation, and that wasn't really made explicit until I turned that into a book some years later. But I did eventually give those lectures, and those lectures were the basis for the first essay I ever had published. It appeared in Boundary 2. And in 1976, it was a response to Edward Mendelssohn's essay on the crime of Lot 49, which I thought was a tremendous essay, but that he'd gotten some stuff wrong. And so I wrote a response to Mendelssohn. It was a kind of a brief article that showed up in Boundary 2, and then that became my first chapter. And it's probably the chapter that most people, if anybody's read my Pynchon book, that's the chapter that people have read. And it's a chapter that's been reprinted and excerpted in a number of places. It's got published in Selected Essays on Thomas Pynchon by Howard Pierce. I think his first name is Howard Pierce. And it's been reprinted by the Gale Publishing Company and some other places that I can't remember. But so I don't know. How are we doing here?
This concludes side 2 of tape 5.